I'm Peter.
And I'm Felice.
Welcome to our travel podcast. We're specialist travel writers, and we've spent half a lifetime exploring every corner of the world.
So we want to share with you some of our extraordinary experiences and the amazing people we've met along the way.
This week, we're in the saddle, or rather, Christian Hoskin and his girlfriend Phoebe are in the saddle for what you might describe, by any standards, as a rather long bike ride. So, Christian and Phoebe, you've done something quite remarkable. You've cycled, I wouldn't say halfway around the world, but a good chunk of it. Where did it start and where did it end?
So, we started in November 2021, just at the tail end of the pandemic, from Ushuaia in Argentina, probably as close as you can get to and the Antarctic in South America. And we cycled over the course of 18 months to Dead Horse, Alaska, which is on the Arctic Circle, on the Arctic Ocean, on the north coast of Alaska.
And you've literally just completed this and you've flown back to England and here we are, is that right?
Exactly, yeah. I flew home 2 days ago. I went straight into a wedding, one of my old school friends. And here I am.
Jet lagged and thrilled that you're not cycling.
Exactly, yeah. Thrilled to have a big old sit down.
And Phoebe, did you do the whole of the trip as well or just some of it?
So I started in Ushuaia and then about 3 months in at the north end of Patagonia, I was walking down a path and I tripped over and managed to break a bone in my foot, which was a very strange accident. So then I flew back to the UK.
Now, as an A&E doctor, which you are, you probably pretty clear straight away what you'd done.
Yeah, I said, that's broken. No one believed me. Everyone was like, you can't have broken it. You were just walking, which is true, I was. It was a weird accident. But yeah, I did have a good idea it was broken, but I had an x-ray. It was broken. It didn't need... I think in Argentina, they thought it needed surgery, but I didn't really think it needed surgery. And I flew back to the UK and they were pretty happy that it didn't need surgery. And then I spent about 2.5 months in the UK while it was healing. And then I flew back to meet Christian in La Paz, Bolivia. And then we cycled together. And then I flew back to the UK again from San Francisco to start working again in February. So I've been at home now for 4 months, maybe, after we left. And he continued on and it got darker and, well, lighter, actually, and colder.
Colder, wetter. And
more bears mosquitoes around.
More bears.
And I was very cozy at home.
What made you do this in the first place? I mean, Chris, you're a mechanical engineer by trade. And did you enjoy doing that?
I did enjoy it, but I definitely, after 2-3 years of working the 9-to-5 life, minimal holiday, I craved a big adventure. And I'd spend uni holidays before going on cycling trips around Europe or around the UK. And every time I'd get back from a month-long trip around Europe with my friends, it takes you about 2-3 weeks for you to kind of get into the swing of things. You learn to live on the bike, living in your tent, knowing where all your things are, just getting used to the simpler life. And then you get to the end and you kind of think, wow, I could have kind of got into the swing of things. And now I'd quite like to carry on going. But then you have to go back and readjust to normal life. So I'd always wanted to do a longer trip for a year or something and just live that way.
And what about you, Phoebe? How did it come about for you? I mean, he came back from work one day and said, I need to go to South America. How did it work?
Well, I think you'd been planning this specific trip for quite a long time. So when we met, he'd already kind of been planning this trip. I've done quite a lot of cycle touring before that as well. And I just thought, yeah, I'll just come along.
Well, Phoebe's cycled around the world already with
what?
Her mum.
What? Tell us about that. That's a bit more than the occasional cycling trip, isn't it?
Yeah, so my mum, her life dream was to cycle around the world. And she thought she'd go when I was 21 because I'd be a kind of independent adult. But turns out I wasn't particularly independent at 21. And I just thought I'd probably just go with her as well. It's a bit of a theme here, actually. So I took a year out of university, of medical school, and me and my mum spent a year cycling around the world.
I think you could say you were fairly well trained for this.
Yeah, I was. I would say that.
So just very briefly, where did you go on that trip?
We started at our house in Surrey and went south through France and Spain, got the ferry to Morocco, went south down Africa to Senegal, flew to Rio, cycled across South America to Santiago, then went to New Zealand and then Australia and then Singapore, from Singapore up to the Chinese border, tried to get Chinese visas, failed, flew again then to Baku on the Caspian Sea in Azerbaijan, and then cycled all the way back from Baku through Eastern Europe back to Surrey.
Back home,
yeah.
Did you do any training before all of this?
We both actually just cycled quite a lot in my daily life. I think you get very used to the sort of physical aspect of it. It's just, you just cycle quite slowly every day. And the first few weeks is always really hard, but then you just get used to it. It's just what you do, really.
How much can you carry on a bike?
I couldn't give you a number, actually. We had four bags each and other bags attached. Well, Chris had a surfboard.
Yeah, so from Peru to Northern Washington, actually, I had a trailer, like a single-wheeled trailer that attached to my seat post on my bike, and I'd strapped a surfboard to the trailer on top. So it was a pretty heavy load, I think. 50 wow. plus kilos.
Yeah.
That is a huge weight. I mean, it's a huge weight when you get to a hill.
It was very big, and it felt a bit stupid, really, because I was having a great time in Peru, Ecuador, where I was by the coast and I was surfing a lot. But as soon as we crossed in the border to Colombia, there's no real coast. There's a coast in Colombia, but the road doesn't go through the coast. The main road goes through the Andes, the mountains and the jungle. So I felt like a bit of a lemon, really. He's up and down with the surfboard and people didn't really know what it was.
I'm not surprised. Yeah.
And we also, even in Peru, we took it up to, what, 4,000 meters? Yeah. Up to
you took your surfboard up to 4,000 meters?
Yeah, and then all the way back down, yeah. As a detour, Phoebe persuaded him to take me on a detour.
I'm surprised you didn't take skis as well.
I was tempted. I kind of thought that as I got to Northern Washington, I was quite tempted to...
Well, there's some great skiing, of course.
Exactly, some really good skiing. So I was tempted to ditch the surfboard and then swap it out for some skis. But, yeah, that would... Realistically, I don't think
it sounds like a mad, crazy adventure. How long did it take?
In total, I think it's 20 months, 19 months,
580 days.
580 days, yeah,
that's a long time,
yeah.
And did you camp every day?
It was definitely a mix. In South America, we camped a lot, mainly because it's very freeing. There's huge opportunities to camp. Any town we'd rock up in, we could just camp in the plaza. Or wherever, really, or just in someone's garden. We definitely stayed.
We really like camping as well.
We really like camping.
Yeah.
We definitely like staying in cheap hotels in South America as well. They're very affordable. I mean, sometimes we pay $5 for both of us just to get a shower, wash your clothes in the sink. But then as we came to America, we used their campsites quite a lot, but we really used warm showers, the cycle touring couch surfing platform that's very, very popular. Especially in America, just because everything's so unaffordable and you get to meet amazing people.
What's it called again?
It's Warm Showers.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. And it's a really, really nice community of people. It's a huge mix, really. They could be young people, retired people. They're often cyclists who've been on trips themselves and have received so much kindness and hospitality that they've then wanted to pay that back to others. And yeah, you just message a complete stranger. You say, I'm coming to Seattle next week, do you have a place? And they're like, yeah, sure. There'll often be a spare room. They'll cook you dinner, share some beers, share some stories. I probably stayed at maybe 10 or 20 of those over the course of America and Canada.
And the non-camping options, even the campsites in America were really expensive for not very much, but the hotels in America were really unaffordable for us.
Yeah.
So we just wiped the budget. So we camped or stayed in these warm showers.
Yeah.
And we also met a few people who on the road who then invited us to stay at their houses a bit later on in the trip, which was also amazing.
We met a couple of
people from California in Mexico, and they said when you get to California, come and stay in our house. So we stayed with them, which was really nice.
I always remember there was a town in Mexico that we rocked up in, and we'd just seen actually loads of military vehicles. I don't know if you remember this as well. And
they'd overtaken us with like men with guns on the top. It's really scary. Yeah.
We thought something bad's happened up ahead of us as we were getting overtaken by people. And they were on the guns, really, fingers on the trigger. So we were following them. We were going towards where they were heading. So we stopped in this town, and because we were in that state of mind, we kind of felt that it wasn't that hospitable and everyone was a bit standoffish and kind of staring at us, being like, what are these guys doing here? Kind of felt in the wrong place. And then we kind of asked someone, can we just sleep in the church, which is often where we would sleep, just as public space that no one's using. And then they're like, oh, you want to sleep in our village? Oh, come camp in our backyard. Come have dinner with us. And we spent the evening with them and their young children. And suddenly the village changed from this kind of harsh...
Yeah, inaccessible place to
to suddenly just being so welcoming and warm. Yeah.
Did you meet because of cycling originally?
I think we met through a friend, but we definitely bonded over cycling. Yeah. And I was obviously very amazed at how Phoebe had cycled around the world. So we definitely bonded over that and heard ridiculous stories. I mean, she was very chaotic. So the the idea of her and her mum, and her mum's chaotic as well. Sorry, yeah. Harriet.
Yeah. No, it's true.
And the idea of them in Western Sahara and Mauritania, I just found it fascinating, really.
And we went cycling together quite soon after we met.
Yeah, we actually, I think our first date was a cycle tour to Pembrokeshire from Cardiff.
Tame compared to the other places.
Well, it was still fun.
It's probably quite dangerous there, isn't it?
In Pembrokeshire, you never know.
You never know what might be around
no
the corner.
No bears found yet, but you never know.
What kind of bike do you need for a journey like that?
I'm of the opinion that, especially for touring in less developed countries, I think having a simple bike that you yourself know how to fix is important. So I've just got a simple steel touring bike with a simple group set, simple brakes. Yeah. I can just replace and fix
it all.
And you can go to a market in South America and you can get all the parts that you need to get you moving again.
I expect you had the odd puncture on the way.
I had a lot of punctures, yeah. You didn't have very many, did you? I think I had probably over 20. But I think you had, what, 3 or 4 or 5?
I probably had 10. Yeah.
Other cyclists like you
have
told us that Baja California is the worst place for punctures. We should explain that Baja California is that thin peninsula that comes down, reaches down into Mexico, which is on the Pacific coast. And it's flat. Is it flat?
It's not that flat, no. It's really not. There were big 1,000-meter hills.
It's separated by a mountain range in the middle that goes up to 2,000, 3,000 meters,
yeah,
I think.
There was snow at the top.
And but it's got some pretty nasty cactus thorns.
It does.
They are the worst. And they have those goat heads, you know, the tiny little balls with spikes on them.
Yeah.
And you will turn off the road to just go for a wee or something. Yeah. And within seconds, you're only a foot away from the road and you've got about 20 in your front wheel.
It's a miniature version of the kind of thing that the police throw down to stop a car.
Yeah,
exactly.
And they certainly stop a bike straight away.
They do.
It's own roadblock.
Yeah, we had one guy, we had a previous podcast, we did episode of a guy who cycled from New York City to Rio, and he said the worst bit was going through Baja California. I think he had 25 punctures in a day or something. He said he was despairing.
We only had one.
Yeah, luckily our tyres, they have a thick layer of gel in them, that so the goat's heads don't pierce that layer unless the tyres are worn out. Yeah. And lots of people ride tubeless down there without inner tubes and the resealing
works. And it's amazing. Tubeless. I think it was a highlight for me, Baja California.
It was a real highlight for me.
Yeah, I loved it.
The camp spots were absolutely incredible.
Dangerous things that happened?
To be honest, the most dangerous was some of the driving in America, I'd say. The closest I think I felt to dying was in a tunnel in Oregon, which got me really upset, actually. I was pretty far over on the road and through a tunnel, and this car, just at 50 miles an hour, just zoomed past and just hadn't seen me. It must have been millimeters. I really felt like I got lucky, and I had to dodge the car, and I was really close to the curb. And it was very terrifying, and especially terrifying because, so I was going north from Ushuaia to Alaska, but most people go from north to south. So in Baja, where we crossed at the end of December, we met all of the people who were going from Alaska down to Patagonia. So we must have met maybe 50 people in the course of a week. So we'd see them on the other side of the road.
Quite a brotherhood in
the region. Absolutely.
There's lots of gossip, but they're all like getting with each other and stuff, I think. There's like a big group of them, yeah.
It's like a school year, isn't it?
Yes, yeah.
They're kind of, I like to call it a cohort, you know. It's like they're the year of 21-22 from Alaska to Patagonia. One of their members died in Oregon. She was hit by a pickup truck from behind, and someone who just hadn't seen her, and they just drove straight through her, and she lost her life. And that was very upsetting for that group because they'd all known her.
Sure.
And she'd had a really tough time in Canada. She had a really close encounter with a grizzly bear at night. I think she had food in her tent, She's completely new to the situation.
So you don't have food in your tent with a grizzly bear.
Exactly. Yeah, it's your number one rule, but I guess she was an inexperienced, it's not her fault, but she was an inexperienced cycle tourist who'd come down to Canada. And yeah, the grizzly bear had been sniffing in her tent, and she'd laid awake all night with her bear spray, just kind of hoping. So she was already upset, and then that happened. Yeah, really horrible. But
apart from that, no real terrible experiences along the way?
We were always amazed at how good our experiences were.
Yeah.
And we always talk about how every single country, they all say that it's going to be dangerous. Enough to make us scared and ourselves. Yeah. So we're in Ecuador, which felt very safe. And then people near the border would say that Colombia is dangerous. And then we crossed the border and, of course, it was very safe. Yeah. And you'd often ask these people, have you ever been to Colombia? And they say, oh, God, no, no.
Yeah. And sometimes even town by town that would happen. They'd say, where are you going today? And we'd say, oh, we're going to this town 100 kilometres up the road. And they'd say, don't go there. It's very dangerous.
And they hadn't even been to the next town. There, yeah.
But I think we felt very safe. Apart from cars, I felt very safe. And lightning, which I'm a bit scared of. Some bad lightning storms. But apart from that, I felt extremely safe all of the time, I'd say.
I suppose lightning on a bike, you need to get off the bike.
Well, we were surfing, actually. We went for a surf in Mexico, and then a lightning storm came in and we kind of had to run across the beach, and then and lightning struck a tree next to us. So I think it was a rational fear that time, although you were already scared of thunder and lightning.
And there was that other time we were cycling in Peru at the top of the Andes, and we could see the lightning hitting pretty near us, and we had to get to that.
Yeah, we saw it hitting
a
church.
To that petrol station, yeah.
So what kind of altitude did you go up to?
Well, we went actually to the highest road in South America, which is at 5,000 meters in Argentina. It's quite funny, really. It's on the main.
Can I just check here? Did you have your surfboard with you there?
No, not at that point. No, but it's the Ruta 40, which is a famous road in Patagonia that goes all the way to the north of the country. It actually goes over the Andes up to 5,000 meters, but it goes from the tarmac in the south. I mean, the road's completely washed out, really. It's inaccessible by cars, but you can go up in a motorbike or on a push bike. And that was really special. That was a kind of expedition in itself, getting up to 5,000 meters and then coming back down.
What are your next plans?
Well, for the moment, I'm excited to come back to Cornwall, see all my friends, see Phoebe, and we're going to go visit family, friends, and kind of just get used to normal life slowly.
Chris has got a new nephew since we've been away, who he hasn't met.
Exactly. So I'm going to go catch up with my brother and my sister-in-law and Rory, and then I'll slowly get used to kind of normal life.
We have to ask, how did you finance all this? Because it's been a long time on the road, and literally on the road. How do you finance that?
Well, I guess I'd been saving up money for a long time, but I actually lost my mum a few years ago. So I was lucky enough to have an injection of cash, which I thought I'd just spend on my dream, really. So I used that sad event to fund my dream, really. And amazing that I got a year and a half of probably the most amazing experience of my life.
If you had wanted to do this on your own, Phoebe, could you have done it, or is it better to do it as a couple?
Yeah, well, I mean, with my mum, we went to a lot of places as two women, and the experience is very different. But I think almost in a way, people want to kind of protect you as a woman. And I think that no one would just like pick a fight with you or, you know, most people just felt so sorry for us. So when I cycled with my mum, I got approached a lot by men wanting to marry me, which was exhausting, but it didn't feel unsafe. It was just kind of annoying.
We had an episode about a guy who cycled from London to Australia to watch the Ashes because he felt that was the way he could get to Australia. He said that the best hospitality as a man he had always was going through Arab countries because hospitality is a part of the culture. Did you find that as a woman?
Yeah, well, it's difficult because in very Islamic countries, the men aren't really meant to talk to women. So that was a bit of a problem. We'd go into a shop and they wouldn't be able to sell us anything because they couldn't talk to us. But yeah, extremely hospitable. But then sometimes that would border on kind of becoming more and more, I don't want to say creepy, but more and more pushy. And I think lots of people in those countries would like a British visa nationality, and that's the easiest way to do it is kind of by getting married. So that was always felt like a bit of an undertone, but yeah, incredibly.
You were never
generous.
Never short of suitors.
Never, no. I had maybe over 50 marriage proposals. So I even started wearing a ring and invented a husband, but it didn't work.
What about your mum? Did she get?
No, my mum thought that everyone was going to want to marry her, so she started wearing the ring, and then quite quickly it was clear that it was me. But sometimes I would reject them, and then they would then go to my mum as a sort of second choice and kind of give. I remember this one man, and I'd sort of been very clear, and then he gave mum some roses, and I got very jealous actually, because. But yeah, so it's a very different experience, but yeah. I think it would be very possible. And we met lots of solo female cycle tourists actually, yeah. And they
did
were
you?
All
That's
having a great time. Yeah. Yeah, or like yeah. two women or...
Often yeah. very inexperienced as well.
You said, I think, that the northern sector of your journey, for you the final sector, was in fact the most dangerous.
People will fly into the Arctic Circle on the Dalton Highway, which is the most remote road in America. So I'm just amazed that people will fly from Europe. They've maybe done a small cycle tour yeah. in Europe, and then they think, okay, we're going to do Alaska, Patagonia, and they start on this remote road, and they have to carry 8 days of food, and it's all gravel roads with lots of climbing. So it's a trial by fire at the start, for sure.
And most people we met, I'd say, wouldn't have done any cycling before, like any actual cycle touring. They might cycle round, but most people, it was their first.
It's crazy not to train properly for these things because...
Well, except to have that kind of length of time to commit to something.
You can only learn how to do it by doing it in a way, especially in South America. It's completely different to cycle touring in Europe, where we'd stop for a pastry break and then we'd stop in a supermarket for our lunch, and instead we'd be shopping in markets for a few days of food. It's just a different experience.
Any advice for people wanting to do what you've done?
I mean, I'd say that it's possible for anyone to do it. You just have to work out how to do it, do your research, but anyone can do it. Some people say, oh, I can never do that. I get tired cycling down the road. You know, anyone can do it. We've met so many people who have never cycled more than 20 kilometers before they head off on their trip, and they just learn how to live that way on the way. And I'm sure there'll be lots of mistakes made that you'll learn from and lots of stories. But
so how often did you actually walk up hills?
Oh, I'm quite strict. I try not to walk up hills, to be honest.
I walked up lots of hills. Not lots of hills, but a few hills. Well, I guess maybe I didn't do... Walking is actually quite difficult. Pushing a bike is actually quite difficult. I like to have a break.
Walking up hills is actually more tiring, I think, than cycling up the hills.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Especially if it's on dirt roads or something, your feet are slipping and it's...
Or at altitude. It's very difficult.
Yeah.
Did you suffer from altitude sickness at all?
Not official altitude sickness, but when we did our climb up to 5,000 meters in Argentina, I struggled with my breathing. Up the last 1,000 meters was very difficult. And that was the one time I did walk up some hills because...
Well, at least now I heli-skied at 5,500 meters and you feel like there's no air at all.
Mm. Yeah, exactly.
You
get a headache and you feel like you're just an unfit person, really. You lose a lot of your fitness. And even at 4,000 meters in Bolivia, you do just feel like a less fit person. And you come down to sea level and it's amazing. And the air feels thick and you feel so energetic.
Thick is the word.
So nice. Yeah. It's so funny that you can, the air literally feels thick, right?
What about clothing? If you got soaking wet, what did you do then?
That is a real problem.
Yeah, that's a problem.
It's a real problem. In Central America, it's very wet. But it's warm, so it's quite nice, really. You wear minimal clothing. And we actually wore sandals for the whole trip with cleats on them. But that was really nice because they're just plastic sandals that dry really easily. So you could get wet and then they dry really easily. But up in North America, I had a bit of a bad winter in North America, in Oregon and Washington. And I was very wet and that's how you get cold and that's how you get hypothermia. It's kind of around freezing wet weather. It can be the coldest weather. And I'd have to turn up at a warm showers and I'd wash and dry everything. And I relied on warm showers really to have every few days a big dry out of my clothes.
quite often we'd have something hanging, drying off the back of our bikes, and it would just stay there for days and days and make no progress with while the drying. Yeah.
And then it would rain and get wet again.
Yeah.
A friend of ours who's a cyclist, she was doing Land's End to Donna Groats, and somewhere in the middle of nowhere, I don't know where it was, she going up a steep hill, and she dropped her pants as she was drying off her back. And the only other pair of pants she had, so she had to cycle all the way down again to find the pants. And she found them on a hedge at the bottom.
Oh, they'd blown away. Yeah.
You lost your swimming trunks, didn't you?
My favourite swimming trunks off the back of my bike, yeah. I think that probably wasn't the only thing that we'd lost off the back. Yeah. Phoebe ruined a very nice swimsuit where it fell off the back of your bike and ended up in the...
In the wheel mechanism.
And in all the cogs and everything.
Shreds, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I really liked that.
Tell us more about the surfboard, because one of the more extraordinary aspects of your journey is the surfboard. Where did you start towing it from?
So, yeah, I guess that did make the trip very unique. I'm not sure I know of anyone who's ever cycled that far with a surfboard. So it was definitely unique, and it was really difficult, I have to say. But a guy in Peru, he made me this trailer. He welded this trailer for me that he had the design that he used for his dog, actually. So it had a nice little basket underneath where I put my bag, and then on top I'd strap the surfboards. And I carried that all the way from Lima in Peru all the way to Washington in America. And I actually I managed to surf quite a lot. Like at the end of the day,
yeah,
we'd camp on the beach, especially in South America, where you can just sleep on the beach. It was the perfect life, really. You'd finish cycling, and then you'd go get in the warm water, go surfing. Exactly, yeah. And we'd sometimes spend a week in places surfing, and it was a really nice balance to the cycling. And surfing is so refreshing. Being in the sea is just amazing, and it makes me happy. So it was really nice to be able to do that at the same time. And I always thought, I really want to do this long cycle up through South America and America, but I couldn't manage to cycle along those coastlines and just watch good waves roll in without me being able to surf them. So it was I had to do it, really.
Apart from your broken foot, did either of you get ill?
It's probably, whenever anyone asks what was the worst experience on your trip, it was definitely for me when we got ill in Peru. We'd filtered some water from a river, which normally is fine, but it was downstream from a town. So in those cases, I guess we've learned you'd use chlorinated tablets or you'd boil the water, but we were drinking just filtered on one of these Sawyer filters. And
it wasn't enough.
It wasn't enough, no. I think we'd got a horrible virus.
Well, I still think it might have been altitude sickness.
Really? Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, we don't know quite what had happened, but
you can be very, very sick from altitude sickness, and you can get big stomach cramps as well.
It's just funny that it was at the same time, which is the only reason I think it wasn't altitude sickness, because it was really weird synchronized timing, but we'd drunk water at the same time. But it would be quite weird for us to respond to altitude with quite such synchronous timing. So I think it probably was a virus from the river water.
But we did this 2,000 meter climb all day. We ended up in the middle of nowhere, Peruvian village, and we went and stayed in this hostel, and it's around freezing again, wasn't it? And no heating, of course, just lots of blankets. And we went in and we were cooking our dinner.
It was actually, they'd advertised hot water on the outside of this hostel, and we went in and there was no shower, and I was asking about the hot water, and he said that we could wash our hands in the hot water, which obviously is nice, but not really.
But a cold shower at 0 degrees is always...
You didn't have any shower. Yeah, there was no shower.
Yeah.
And the room was, do you remember, the room was really expensive, so we negotiated, and he let us stay in their storeroom, which had some bunk beds in. But we thought we were only going to stay there for a night, but it wasn't very nice. And then, we were just...
Around 6 p.m., we both, it just suddenly hit us, and we were just vomiting for all night, really, together, sharing... we had this...
synchronized vomiting.
Yeah, we did. And we had this portable sink made of plastic that we do our washing up in, that turned into our... We turned it inside out, and it turned into our sick bucket. And we had to take it in turns to go... We'd fill up the bucket, and then we'd have to go outside into the freezing cold to empty it. and we'd take it in turns. I think Phoebe might have done a solid, actually, and emptied it more than me.
In terms of building a relationship, that's really character-forming.
Pretty character-forming, yeah. But we ended up having to spend the whole of the next day in this tiny village.
And the owner was extremely confused while we were staying.
Yeah, yeah.
Ill.
Really ill. And then we had to get out of there, really. Yeah. So we weren't well again, but we were well enough to cycle. But we had no food inside us, no energy. And we had to...
We were at 4,500 metres. We really just had to get down.
We had to get down.
That is incredibly high. You know.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
That was about as high. Apart from the big climb, that was... We had a few days where we were on this like 4,500 meter plateau, which is probably about the highest.
And it wasn't flat to get out of it either. We had to go up and down to get off it.
What was the best part of the trip?
I think I was really, really impressed with the glacier, the Perito Moreno Glacier in Argentina, which is one of the only glaciers that's still growing. Yep. And there were just huge ice chunks falling off. And it was so spectacular on the turquoise blue lake. We went on a boat trip to go see it, and it was just absolutely wonderful. And I'd say also the Acatenango volcano in Guatemala. We hiked up, camped right next to this volcano, and we'd rolled up our tent door, and we just were lying down all night watching this volcano erupt. It was so close, and you can hear it. That was really special.
Thank you both very much indeed. A fascinating story. We wish you every luck with the next adventure.
Oh, thank you so much.
That's all for now. If you've enjoyed the show, please visit our website, actionpacktravel.com, or you can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, or any of the many podcast platforms. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'd love you to sign up for our regular emails too, at peter@actionpacktravel.com. Until next week, stay safe.
And I am you.
And you are me.
It's just a crazy storm.